Oh, hi. I didn't see you there. This is The Singer's Vault, episode 1 of season 2. And in a slight change of plans, I'm your host, Tim Takash, composer, person, singer, and I have with me as my guest today, Dr. Matthew Culleton of The Singers. Hi, Matt.
Hi, it's just great to be with you here in my living room.
It's
The Singer's Vault.
Thank you for letting me invite myself over to your living room into The Singer's Vault. Is
You're
this
welcome.
The vault, this room right here?
It's, no, this is a dining room now.
Yeah, it doesn't look like a vault, but it's a pleasant dining room. So I wanted to take an episode and sort of grab the mic, as it will, and ask you a bunch of questions that I'm curious about, things that I think maybe your audience would like to know, things your singers would like to know, and just sort of dig deep into you as a person and as a musician.
Sure, let's turn it on its side.
Please. I'd love to start out, if we can, with you as a kid, as a musical child, as a brother, as a son. What was your childhood like? Just paint a quick picture of what we could picture.
Well, we were always very active musically growing up. My twin brother, Michael, director of the Concordia Choir, and I, always active in band, choir, orchestra, any choir we could sing in with Bob Sieving. And our younger brother, Mark, went the way of more sports. He was kind of a soccer player, rugby player. Tried orchestra for a little bit, tried choir for a little bit. But we grew up, Michael and I, very active in music. And we had like the biggest bedroom in the house. And it had keyboards from the Casio SK-1 up to like something with 3 octaves. And our first stereo, our first CD player. And it had music stands. And it was not a rare event to have the door closed while conducting a Beethoven symphony off of a cheap Dover score we bought at Schmidt.
At what age was this?
This would have been in like 9th through 12th grade, in high school, essentially. And then when Bob Sieving introduced us to the King's Singers, we would often put our stands kind of side by side, and we would like just, we'd buy all the scores for whatever CD just came out. Yeah, sometimes I'd play the Alistair Hume countertenor part or sing it, and Michael would sing the Stephen Connolly bass, or, and then we'd go through the CD again and flip parts. So ours was definitely a house of scholarship and academia.
And this was a...
bullying.
This was a brotherly activity for the two of you?
It was often. Otherwise, yeah. Otherwise, I'd sing through the Madrigal History Tour and then loop back. And the funny thing is we also... you know, this was back in like early Nintendo and Sega Genesis days, Atari 2600. We'd be playing Frogger and we'd have the CD of Chanticleer's 10th anniversary. And we would just keep looping like the Palestrina motets to play Frogger to that. So maybe it was destiny just from an early age.
Yeah, it's funny because you say that and I immediately remember my Sega playing days. And I would be listening to the Nylons
or the Bobs,
some musical score that had just come out, playing video games, listening to music.
I just found a stack of all my Nylon CDs, and I went back up on the roof and Happy Together.
How do they hold up?
Some of it holds up beautifully.
Yeah.
You know, and then my ears are better, and we've lived in this world, so you kind of go, we could fix that today.
Yeah.
Pitch correction, but, I mean, they're the Nylons.
Yeah, you can't argue with that.
No.
So I'm picturing your mother, who doesn't take any of your bull roar,
right,
calling you guys down, like, stop conducting, it's time for dinner.
Oh, sure.
It's a common thing.
Third movement only, there's one more, you know. You're waiting for that awkward transition in Beethoven in 5.
And you want to be there to conduct it.
Oh, yeah. Well, how's it going to happen otherwise?
So it surprises me that you're conducting at such, to me, a young age, because I don't think that... Well, it never crossed my mind to be a conductor. And so were there formative events or things that happened as a musical child that led you, that were conducting called out to you as a passion, where it's like, oh, this I really feel comfortable with?
Yeah, for Michael, I remember actually Bob Sieving turned over the Chamber Singers. I think Michael at that time had just transcribed by ear the MLK from the King Singers and recorded or conducted the Chamber Singers. And, you know, we were kind of like always in the pit orchestra if we weren't in the show. And
playing what?
I played clarinet in the pit orchestras. I play the French horn too, but I was only gutsy enough to share my clarinet playing in a number of St. Cloud's pit orchestras growing up. I remember once during Guys and Dolls, the stage broke while moving it during a show, and the conductor, Chris McDermid, Aaron McDermid's dad, was also the stage builder. So he had to go back while the curtain was down and try to fix this caster or something. And I just stood up and conducted the, I think, the on-track over and over and over until it was done. So it was fixed and Chris could come back. So just sort of funny things like that. But we had a really outstanding band program at Apollo too. Don Nelson, I think both Michael and I would say that we're in classical music because of a great transcription we played of the Marriage of Figaro Overture as sophomores in band. And then you just play these great things throughout and just lights you up. And so we were blessed on every musical front growing up in St. Cloud, from elementary days with Karen Cruz to Louise Clinton and junior high and Bob Sieving, who really kind of lit us up to be musical and to be conductors. And I went to Concordia on the political science track. I was going to be a lawyer, poli-sci. And pretty quickly, I felt a different pull back to music.
Yeah,
I thought I was going to go there and be a lawyer. Renee Clausen, who's become obviously one of our great life mentors and occasional golf partner, he was on sabbatical our first year. And honestly, when I went to Concordia, we had sung a piece by Renee Clausen, but the Concordia choir and things, it wasn't an immediate draw for me because I was going to go a different route anyway. But felt the pull that we do and came back and all music all the time.
Well, we're glad you're here.
Yeah, thanks.
I think in retrospect, you would have made a great lawyer.
Yeah, I still love reading policy and really kind of getting into the weeds. And
yeah.
So.
Yeah, that is definitely a part of your personal brand. Yeah. So that pull back to classical music, specifically into being a conductor, I didn't realize that you were an instrumentalist as well growing up, but instrumentalist, you're a singer, you're a composer, you're a conductor. How does one choose conducting as the thing that you want to pursue musically and as a career?
I think in the case of conducting, it often finds you. You know, I just kind of feel like there's so much in it that's got to come naturally too. And there's obviously tons you can learn and thankfully do. But yeah, it almost is like this inner calling to do that. And I think it's the same with composing. There's this inner calling to put stuff on paper. And that's more of kind of my second or third area, of course, to some other things. But for me, you know, as a kind of raging introvert, I've always liked the control of putting the people I want in the room together. I think that part of my personality, which is comically different than Michael, who I think got most of the extrovert genes in the womb. But how much like being an introvert has, and picking my people, has led to things from the tone of the choir to the personality of the groups and who comes in and who makes it. And why I beg people not to leave.
Yeah, because you found your people.
Yeah, exactly. Right? So
well, can you talk more about the audition process of building the choir and not only getting those folks in the room, you know, what you're looking for? Is it just what they sound like? Is it how they are to work with? Can you tell when you work with them in a room if you want to be with them weekly?
Yeah, for sure.
And then also talking about when you look at a choir on stage, why does that person stand there and that person stand there? Is there a science to how you put them up in the ranks in specific spots?
Yeah, the audition process starts with me in non-COVID times, at least, having them come to a table and check in. And usually over the years, they've met somebody who's already in the choir. And I usually have good, like, table greeter personalities there who can kind of talk them up a little bit, answer questions first. And then they come up into the room and they sing an art song for me. And I give all people who audition prepared excerpts, too. 9 times out of 10, it's one Argento excerpt and one Handel. Because I really just want to see what the flexibility is right away.
Yeah.
And that ability to kind of flip styles is one of the main things I look for. Because even though there's a conductor in the group, we're often trying to feel things out more like a chamber ensemble. And choirs the size of ours, like usually around 40, to get them to behave like a chamber ensemble, to me, is really important. And I think it's because I've always liked singing in small groups, and I've just learned a lot about that and how we behave together. But yeah, you're right. You are also deciding, can I live with this person in the group for a year? I learned that from Dale. To get into the Dale Warland Singers, you know, Dale was asking himself, can I live with this person for a year, and can others in the choir live with this person for a year? Because it's a real trust activity, singing together, as you know, and you just want to be in a room with people that you really can make good music with. You don't have to get along perfectly, you know, we're still people, but yeah, there's just a dynamic you can feel. And then in terms of the artistry that they present in their art song, I can usually tell in 4 to 8 measures if they're going to make it. And usually if they can sight read well, and if they come in prepared on the prepared excerpts, that's the real path into the singers. Mm-hmm. And then when you ask about like seating the choirs and is there a science to it, I've really come to think that there are many different sciences to it. For me, I've started to really just accept that I like what I like when I hear it. And that for me, there's no longer an interest in assigning reed, wind, and flute to voice types. And I think that's where Sig Johnson is one of the wizards of voicing choirs. And you see how she just listens to singers when she walks down the row. And I saw it as a high school kid in one of her honors choirs. And really,
Sig Johnson conducted the Manitou Singers for a long time at St. Olaf. Yeah. And worked with Vocal Essence a lot.
Yeah, and was a longtime partner of Dale's.
Sure.
So she's significant in this area. And at college, Renee would often try to find the reeds, winds, and flutes as well. And so there's maybe some St. Olaf to that. But for me, I kind of allow more open thinking about this voice might just really work with this voice. Mm-hmm. And then there is the whole level of, will sitting next to this person make me a better artist? Because I've sat next to a number of singers, Bruce Broquist, for instance, when I started in the Dale Warland Singers. Singing the Poulenc Mass in G next to Bruce Broquist, you learn immediately what it means to be a pro choral singer. Like, you come in and you already know it, you know. Happily, Bruce is still making music with the singers as well, but I just kind of think sometimes putting one person next to another person could make them both better artists. That's what I'm really after.
Yeah. There's that lovely feeling that by going through a process like that, in the seats as a chorister, as a singer, you just soak up what you're next to.
Yeah.
You know, you sort of become a better person, musician because of that.
Well, I remember once when we were being seated by Jerry Rubino in the Warland Singers, Tim O'Brien and I loved sitting next to each other. So we would sing purposefully worse next to somebody else in the line when he was voicing us. And then when we were next to each other, we locked in.
You're a dog.
I mean, it was totally misbehavior. But in the end, we believe it served Dale the most.
Yeah, there you go. You got to game the system a little bit to get what you want. Earlier, you mentioned playing a specific piece in band that really like cemented you into classical music and maybe put you further along that path.
Yeah.
I think repertoire choice for an ensemble is a big piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
You know, it's a big part of that recipe of how a group functions and what their brand is.
Yep.
I also feel like some folks really have a brain for keeping repertoire in a little mental place in their head.
Yeah.
And some, like for me, for instance, as soon as I'm done singing it and I turn that score back in, it's mostly gone. Unless there was a significant memory attached to it. It's just, I don't retain it like that.
Yeah.
So how do you, first of all, tell me about your repertoire brain. And then how do you find repertoire for the singers? How do you think about what you want to hear, what your audience wants to hear, what the singers really like, the singers meaning your group?
Yeah. Well, for me, I do have not a photographic memory by any stretch, but I remember walking into 10th grade concert choir, and on the risers in the front of the room was Bob Chilcott's Gift to Be Simple, John Nesbeck's Gloria, and a David Wilcock psalm setting. I just remember that was my first day in 10th grade. And I've kind of held on to music that way in my brain. But most importantly, I don't do it alone. I don't program alone. I don't work in that kind of a way. I've often joked that my first degree is actually from Dale Warland University. Because when I started with Dale in 1999, I was just this 23-year-old kid who taught choir up in Long Prairie at Gray Eagle, drove 2.5 hours almost to rehearsal, 2.5 hours home. And so by the third year I was with Dale out of 5, I was music advisor, and we would program together and edit together. So I learned I didn't want to do that alone either. Dale and I would look at stacks of music for the next season, and obviously we're tossing out like 95% of what we're looking at. And so since the beginning of the Singers in 2004, Brian Blessing and I have programmed together. And Brian sings baritone in the choir and grew up in Staples, Motley. And when I was in Long Prairie, I sang in the Staples area men's chorus, Stan mm-hmm. Carlson conducting. And over in the tenor section was one of his high school kids, Brian Blessing. So we've known each other since 1998. Mm-hmm. And then Brian student taught with me when I was teaching at Hopkins, and he was a student at St. John's. So Brian is who I've known the longest in the choir. We program everything together. It's just way more fun to have conversations about it. And I always tell Brian, I'm going to say no to your ideas way more than I say yes, but I'd be lost programming without him.
Yeah, there's something magical about getting two brains together on something, especially when it's something so subjective as programming. Because I often used to think that looking at a program that I have to perform, if there were a couple pieces on it that I really didn't like, it's probably a really good program, right? Because there are people out there who just don't have the same tastes, right?
Like sure.
You program some stuff for yourself, you program some stuff for other people.
Yeah.
And Brian just has a real ear for keeping an eye on what's new and what he likes, and
there's a benefit there. That's a really important relationship for us because, you don't want to look at it through just one lens. And you want to make sure you're programming things that challenge the artists, challenge the audience, but also not necessarily challenge the audience so much as let them understand there's a story we're telling and try to put it in the context of today. And that's one of the great challenges now coming back after the pandemic period is to come back and celebrate musically being back together, but also just pause and share music that speaks to what society's just been through for the last not only 18 months, but hundreds of years. The racial reckoning, the COVID, the losses we've all endured. It just feels to me like to start up again, but to not acknowledge that is a real swing and a miss. Mm-hmm. Because we play an important role. And, you know, a lot of times throughout especially the racial reckoning that we've had here in the Twin Cities alone, mm-hmm. you know, the thought comes to, what would Leonard Bernstein have done? You know, Leonard Bernstein wouldn't have sat quietly and then come back and programmed the wordless anthems of Frederick Delius. You know, why would you do that? You wouldn't. You'd put yourself in it. So that's our big challenge right now, is to make sure that, you know, we really live and breathe the mission that we've got.
Is there something that you've missed the most about not being able to be with your choir?
Yeah, not being with my choir. the people, you know, we named this choir after them.
Yeah.
And for me, it's my week with the artists, and we only get one rehearsal a week with the singers, sometimes two, but you know, it's about the people for me. And it's the same with my church group at House of Hope. We were back this past week for the first time in a little while. And, boy, it was electric to be back singing. Yeah, I missed the people. I missed the challenge to make great art. And for me, it was really fun on Wednesday night with the church choir to not talk about the masks or COVID or whatever, but to just talk about crescendos and articulations in Baroque music. And, you know, I think we all just loved taking a break from the news and all that. So,
yeah,
that's what I miss the most, the people. It's an insular job otherwise. It's a lot of score study and...
Yeah.
Time at the piano. And so
when you come back to making music after this hibernation that we've had,
how does it
change? I mean, you've done it a little bit at church and you'll be looking forward to doing it with the singers, but are there muscles that need to be restretched out? Where do you start?
I think you start with a more open mind than when you left. You have to accept that the artistry is going to be a little different. It's going to be great, but it's going to be great. Mm-hmm. It doesn't start there. And singers are out of shape. There's not been a lot of singing in the last 18 months. Conductors' shoulders are out of shape. Yeah, it's just, for me, I'm trying to use this as a really necessary sort of refresh and ask myself, what kind of leader do I want to be on the flip side? You know, if you don't find some silver linings in this last 18 months, it was all for naught. And I think the silver lining is you get a reset, you get a forced sabbatical, And you get to ask yourself what kind of leader you want to be on the flip side. And for me, I want to be a leader that unites the artists, unites our people, and laughs a lot during rehearsal. You know, there's no sense to come in like it's the world's hardest work. I think it's some of the world's most important work. But if we don't laugh while we're doing it, and if we don't just make fun of ourselves on the flip side, it's going to be a long slog back. And in many ways, it was a gift of time to recalibrate. And I think our artists needed it. I needed it. And our board took advantage of it to really ask questions about who we are going forward. And we had been starting some important strategic discussions about a year and a half ago. Actually, now 2 years ago, because we were kind of in the midst of it when everything happened in town here, too, with the George Floyd murder and things like that. So it came at a time where we were really starting to dig in, and then we really decided to explore who we are.
Yeah.
And we're an arts group. We're going to tell stories that I think matter, and we're going to celebrate the great choral art.
Yeah. I love that idea that you have a chance to reset and recalibrate, because I think it is easy to forget that we do this for the joy.
Yeah.
We do it for the love of making music, of giving music to other people. Yeah. And you can get caught up in the, I don't know if it's a whirlwind or if it's a conveyor belt or what, but there's just the work that needs to be done every day and every week. And that can feel grinding after a while. And so to not have it.
Right.
And especially I think for the audiences to not be able to experience it. I imagine that most audience members will come back with a renewed sense of what they get out of a live performance, out of a performance by the singers. And they'll be able to really tell how they leave that room as a different person.
Yeah, it's a good time for us all to take stock.
Peace and grace be to this house where all are welcomed in. Receive the guest, receive this heart. Tell the stranger,
have brought repertoire to life
as
new commissions and new premieres. And from my perspective on the composer side of things, and you know this too, there are risks and a lot of unknown involved in making that new piece of music and sending out into the world. From the conductor's side of things, what are you thinking about? What risks are there for you? Are there worries or considerations that you carry along with you into a new piece, whether that's for good or for bad, you know, whether it's baggage or whether it's a really great set of tools that you need to take with you? How does that work?
Well, I like to leave the risk up to the composer. I try to minimize it on my end, but yeah, so what's our great risk? I mean, we get to share new art with an audience, you know, so maybe it might be hard, but so we do that. Maybe it might stretch the artistry. Good. Maybe it brings new texts to life or old texts in new light. Great. Maybe it's a programmatic challenge where we had a Brahms motet as part of the B-side of the album and now we have Helios. It's like, great, make it work, you know, or something like mm-hmm. that. I mean, I guess it used to feel riskier, but I've always had the good fortune with you and Jocelyn and Abby and Josh. You're all singers. Yours are the easiest scores to put in front of a choir because they're from singers. Phrasing is natural. Breathing always comes when it should. Single syllable words stay single syllable. I mean, you have that singer sense about it. So maybe I just don't feel like it's as risky as it used to be for me. Our audiences are used to and embrace new music. And so in that way, it doesn't feel like a risk. But I think if we can work with composers who are feeling like they have a wider palette than they might otherwise, and they can take some risks, awesome. I like being that group for composers. Not to say that it's always easy or we get a score and go, oh, this will be a piece of cake. But yeah, I try to leave the risk up to the composers.
And you've one of the things that I've always appreciated about you as a conductor looking at a score is that you're very intentional about following the instructions that are on the page.
Yeah.
And if one thing is if it's unclear, you'll ask.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't feel right, you'll ask.
Sure.
You know, and yeah. So I love that sense of collaboration that you bring to that process where you'll say, it says this, but I'm feeling this. What do you think?
Yeah.
You know, and talking about those moments, I think really helps the art live and breathe in a better way.
Yeah, it's fun to collaborate and to have kind of this policy of just open-mindedness in bringing your scores to us. On my birthday, Jocelyn put that beautiful post up where she told the story about she brought in, I think, the Sanctus from a mass. And I said, your tempo is definitely wrong. And she didn't quite believe me until we sang it. And I think, I know we changed after that. But in terms of like where that comes from for me, I'm really glad I am a singer and that I'm still an active singer. Because most of my suggestions to the composers really have to deal with how we can make it more efficient for the artists. Never how do we make it easier, but how can we make it more successful for everybody? And I just figure I'm an extension of the singers in the choir at those points. But I think that really does frame a lot of the things from tempo choices to other questions or things that aren't always as clear on the first draft.
So on the flip side of things, when you're bringing music to the stage that you've done before, the audience has heard before, there's recordings of it out there, the singers in your ensemble have all sung it under different conductors.
Sure.
How do you do that differently? Do you feel like you need to break new ground with some of that repertoire? Do you feel tied to the beloved way that it's been recorded that everybody knows and loves? Yeah. How do you approach that differently?
Well, my people are different. And so I never feel tied to how Dale might have recorded something or, you know, what L.A. Master Crowell might have done with it. We're better because we've heard their recordings, too. There's certainly a level of being informed. But, you know, I think of it in the same way orchestras think of recording their Beethoven cycle. It's like, great, we need another Beethoven cycle. But programming is sort of your way of putting your stamp on your organization's history, too. And we were doing this. But also on our upcoming CD, we're releasing, we include Samuel Barber, Reincarnations, recorded a ton, but not recorded by these 40 singers at one time. And so, you know, my interpretive choices are with them in mind and the capabilities we have, which thankfully give me a wide palette of things to work with. And I'm just as excited to hear them sing a piece like The Coolin by Samuel Barber as I am something brand spanking new. Like, okay, let's see what they do with this. And then what do I do to shape it? You know, I still have my opinions and things, but I think there's great value in recording and living with choral music that is sort of still our a large part of our history.
Yeah. Well, and for those of us that listen to you sing and perform, it's like a destination, in my mind at least. When I hear a great piece of music, I think of the singers as a destination. Think, well, this is a tight piece of music, but now I want to hear these folks do it. You know, like, because you can hear that sound and you can hear the attention to detail in your mind and how you all treat that live performance. And there's certain things I want to hear you hear. I want to hear you on this. I want to hear you do this. So like, I could make a playlist of all the stuff that I want to hear you do.
That.
Do.
Send it to me, Brian.
I will.
Oh boy!
Wow, that got exciting.
Time up. That's Rocky the Pomeranian.
He got excited about repertoire too a little bit there.
Yeah.
When you started the Singers back in 2004.
Yep.
I imagine you had a pretty clear picture in your mind of what the group could be or would be, how it would sound, what you'd perform, who was in the audience. Have there been any surprises along the way, along the last 16, 17 years? Or have you constantly been sort of whittling down toward that original mental image of what this group could or should be?
My kind of sonic imagination has changed over time with the people in mm-hmm. the choir. I don't try to bring them to a specific ideal. It's just that I know that I like kind of a balance of pyramid shape, more bass, more alto on the bottom to give foundation, an alto and tenor section that kind of sound interchangeable, and a soprano section that's very flexible that can go, you know, full out on an opera chorus or rein it in a little bit. And just dexterity is so important. But for me, the sound just needs to be vibrant, and I don't love the straight tone singing or anything like that. It's kind of a important color, but there's times for it. So for me, I think my sound ideal is really just based on who's in the room and how beautiful can we make our sound.
Do you find that some years you have certain colors to play with and some years you don't?
Sure. Based on the yeah. People? Oh, yeah. Yep. When we have a singer who departs who's kind of been a key voice in their section, I know that that's something that we don't replace sonically, but, you know, we get a new person's take on it. And that's exciting, too. But, yeah, I mean, when I hear the singers on the radio or on a playlist or something, I know it's us. And I've separated, like, it's not because I recognize producing the recording or that kind of thing. It's like, you just hear the voices that do that right there. And you just have memories and things like that. And, like, when we come back now and people are 18 months rusty, my sound ideal is going to be a little different. Like, okay, we've got work to do.
Right.
I finally will have something to work toward.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I don't really have a specific sound because I want it different on Fern Hill than I do on It Had to Be You at a Gala or something like that. Yeah. So,
do you have an earliest recording of the group where you hear it and you go, that's the first time I really achieved what I wanted to hear out of these folks?
Yeah, I think our Lordson CD may still even be maybe my crowning artistic achievement. And that was 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had a lot of mountaintop since, of course. But mm-hmm. yeah, I put that in and I think, what a vitality. What a presence of sound. And to have Morten Lordson in the room for that and playing on a few of the tracks, it was just a very engaging process. A lot of the artists still talk so meaningfully about mm-hmm. what that session, you know, that's 3 or 4 nights where we start at like 8 o'clock and go to midnight, and they still remember it very fondly. And recording like that's a tough slog, but yeah, that I think that CD was kind of the ideal for me.
Is there a track from that you can play for us and cue up that we can listen to what that sounds like?
Oh yeah, I think the opening track of the CD, right away I hear just this vibrancy of tone as we sing about the rose. A lot of people would pick probably Sure on the Shining Night or Direton, but it's some of these other things that to me just really capture where their hearts were that week. Yeah.
So I just got in the mail yesterday, before we recorded this, a beautiful postcard from the Singers about the whole 21-22 concert season, which is so lovely to be able to see all that in print and just keep our fingers crossed that we're able to make these. I love that your first event in October is outside in the park. It's a pay-what-you-can event. You just seems like you've got your arms wide open.
Yeah, that's sort of where we're at.
Welcoming people back. Yeah. What can we expect on that concert in October?
It's definitely going to be a celebration of being back together, both as a group of artists, but also as an audience, and enjoying some real upbeat stuff by Sean Kirchner out of Los Angeles. Great composer, great arranger. Things like Unclouded Day and Angel Band, which is just sort of feel-good, coming-home music for us. But like I said earlier, too, it's really important that we stop and reflect musically on what we've been through. And to do that, we've got a piece by Alicia Lee, called Say Her Name, reflecting on some of the racial reckoning that we're going through right now. And Issei Barnwell's Wanting Memories, which is a piece that's been in our rep for most of our 20 years. We haven't done it for a number of years, but we sang that one early. And that'll be back. But then also things by Jake Renestad, Let Our Love Be Heard, and music by Dale Warland, who this year we celebrate kind of throughout the season, both you and I, actually, as we are in Dale's 89th year and looking forward to his 90th birthday in the spring. We're going to start to do some of his music and sprinkle that throughout the year as well. So it is sort of arms wide open. Let's celebrate, but let's pause, let's reflect, let's take stock, and let's leave with our arms continuing to be wide open.
Is there a recording of something that you have on that concert we can listen to just as a primer?
Yeah, let's take a listen to Issei Barnwell's Wanting Memories. We did this, this is a live recording from season 3, a piece that our audiences love. I thought it'd be nice to come back with it.
Sounds good, let's listen to that one.
You've gone and left me there.
think on the things that made me grow into a being full of pride. Think on these things, for they are true. And I am sitting here wanting Chamarise to teach me to see the beauty in the world through my own.
Wanting Memories is such a great piece for, I really think, for everybody except for the basses.
Yeah.
Really.
Tenors get to do a little
shake. They get a little something in there. But, you know, it's one of those pieces that, as a singer, you can really dive into those words. And I think everybody has their own story that they're telling.
Yeah.
They're seeing specific people in their mind. I think the audience is doing the same thing, totally. But the whole room feels like they're together. And you mentioned like putting people in the same place and feeling like you're unified.
Yeah.
I think that piece does it.
Yeah.
You know,
I agree. Looking forward to doing it again.
And I think that it also exemplifies something that that you do with the singers. And it is all about the people in the room, right? I think a lot of us think about conductor and we think about a singular personality. You think about somebody who wants that control of the group, of the room, of the program. And all that I've heard today throws that back continually onto the artists.
Yeah.
You know, and you're thinking about what they get out of the musical experience. Mm-hmm. You're thinking about what the audience gets out of experience. And you bring old music, you bring new music, you do it with such a vitality and attention to detail that anybody who comes in the room is going to leave with something special.
Yeah,
I just love that about you and about the group. And it's a pleasure to be involved. And so thanks for taking this time out of your schedule to let me interview you.
Oh, it's been a treat.
Season 2, episode 1 of The Singer's Vault. And so for those of you listening, thanks for spending some time with us. And hopefully we'll see you live at a Singer's event sometime soon.
Thank you, Tim. Thanks, everybody. We'll catch you for episode 2.